All week, cars full of documentary film nerds have been headed toward Columbia, Missouri from all directions for a weekend-long festival called True False. It's been going on every year since 2003, and in that time, it's become a pretty big deal. This year's festival started yesterday. Stacey Wolfel is in Columbia now, and Stacey, what's the vibe right now? Set the scene for us.
The vibe is really starting to pick up here. The film started last night, as you say, and so the streets of Columbia were packed with moviegoers. There's also a masquerade on the first night, an opening night party before the first big film. And so
a masquerade. Wait, I need you to tell me more, because I don't think it's totally intuitive that documentary films would be accompanied by a parade.
Well, there are a lot of things not intuitive about True False, all in a good way. But yes, there's a masquerade. So there might be somebody with a wolf's head or a fancy Venetian get up here walking around last night headed to another film.
Why?
Because they want to make it's a party that lasts 4 days here. There's later today is the March, a parade down Broadway where people can dress up or not, and they just get out and march because it's March.
I mean, I guess that makes sense. That's the name of the month.
That's the vibe of the festival. There's all sorts of parties. There are art installations around town, outdoor art, indoor art, all performers performing on the street. So it's a little different than a football weekend in Columbia. This is a different crowd, a different vibe.
Tell me more about the transformation of Columbia over True False Weekend.
Well, much of it takes place inside, of course, where places that are normally lecture halls and churches and music halls become cinemas. So that's going on inside, and those are elaborately decorated in some cases, all put together to make that theater-going experience exciting for people. The lobbies get decorated, and there's art in there. And then outside, there are sculptures pop up overnight, usually on Wednesday night, and there'll be something that wasn't there before. Right outside my office here in the journalism school, there's usually this sort of strange wooden corridor that they set up that people can walk through. And frankly, the winds on Wednesday night took that down, so it's off for repairs. But these things just pop up overnight, and you see them the next morning, and they're there.
Can you give an example of a sculpture that you have seen pop up this year?
Yeah, there's a great one over by the Rheinsberger Theater, which is typically a live theater stage that's being used as a cinema. And so the True False logo is a circle with white and red and the letters TF in it. They've used the same logo forever. And so someone has built this thing, and it's hard for me to describe on the radio, but it stands on legs. And I think from above, it's got some form of the logo, but of course you can't get above it. It probably sits about 4 feet high and is probably about 10 feet across. And it's lit from underneath. I walked out with my wife last night, and I kind of walked around it to look at it. So it's like part spider and part bird's nest and part something else. And it's just right in the middle of the sidewalk when you come out of the theater.
And so people are used to the idea that over this weekend, things like this happen. You don't know who put it there or why, and it's just part of life?
We assume the fest put it there, but we don't know who the artist is. They're usually not marked, though. If you go to the website, True False website, they've got some information about the artists who are doing these things. Sometimes they are perishable, too. There was a sculpture outside the Ragtag Cinema, sort of home base for True False. And I'm not sure what it was made out of, but if they knew it was going to rain during the festival, I think this was last year or the year before, and whatever it was made out of slowly melted through the festival and revealed another sculpture inside what the outer sculpture was. So, and it's different things every year.
Well, that does get at what is true and what is false, the sculpture within the sculpture. You know, this festival, you mentioned the Ragtag Cinema as home base. The festival started with just a few venues and easy walking distance there. And there are more venues than this now. But, you know, there was the Ragtag, which is kind of a cute hodgepodge art house theater with like mismatched chairs and sofas. And then there's the Missouri Theater, which has a really pretty crazy history. Can you tell us about those venues that have been part of this thing all along?
I can. Ragtag is home base, and it's a little twin art cinema. One side holds about 140 people, and it has fairly traditional theater seats, so it has a pull-up desk like you'll remember from school or college. But the other is Little Ragtag, the Willie Wilson Theater, as it's called now, and it does have couches and chairs, and it only holds about 45 people or so. So that's a very intimate movie-going experience. And the festival puts kind of the small, weird films in those smaller locations, but the big crowd-pleasing films, there's one called Step in the fest this year that's about a Baltimore step team, and that's a huge crowd-pleaser. So they put those in the big venues like the Missouri Theater. I played there last night. And that's an old-time movie theater, a bit like the Uptown Theater in Kansas City there, that has really been lovingly restored. And I saw not Step, but another film in there last night, and it's just such a great place to see that. And you mentioned walking distance. It's one of the great things about the festival is all the venues. I think the longest walk you'll ever have between venues is 15 minutes, and the average is more like 6 or 7. And that's better than a lot of festivals. You think Sundance, the king of the festivals, you can't walk between venues there. You have to get on a shuttle bus and ride. And so that's one of the great pluses of True Falls.
You are a professor at MU, where you head the Jonathan B. Murray School of Documentary Journalism. And so I feel like you might have some perspective on this. I mean, why do you think people come swarming to Columbia for this festival in a day and age where you can technically watch documentaries on Netflix all day long if you want to?
You can watch documentaries on Netflix all day long, but you won't watch these documentaries, I would say. And so it's the taste of the program team, I think, is a big part of it, because I won't say there's something for everyone. There's probably some people who won't like anything that they program, but they go for really cinematic documentaries, a certain genre of documentary that's popular now. So some films that you'll see at Sundance are here, but also some films that they find from around the world. And I saw actually both films I saw yesterday. It's their first U.S. Showing. And so it's not played anywhere else before. One's a Polish documentary called Communion about a sister and brother that's just terrific. And another one last night called Rat Film, which is exactly about that, rats in Baltimore, and a very almost experimental documentary. And I'd be willing to bet neither one of these ends up on Netflix. It's not the kind that you'll see there. So people come to this festival to see docs they're not going to see anywhere else.
Well, Stacy Wolfel at MU in Columbia, have fun with the rest of the True False weekend.
We will. It's only just begun.
Okay. Have a great time. So people there are psyched about the True False Film Festival, featuring documentary films, as we just heard, from all over the world. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we're going to talk to a few directors who are in Missouri to screen their movies. We'll start with Peter and Petra Lataster, a Dutch duo with a movie that takes place in one classroom. It's called Miss Keats' Children. And Peter, why don't we start with you? Tell our listeners what's interesting about Miss Keats' Classroom.
Hi, Gina. Hi. What's interesting? I think it's interesting because it's so familiar, which maybe sounds a bit crazy, but I think also you and listeners can remember the time when you were in elementary school and there was this one teacher who was a special person for you, who just did something for you or sparked something in your mind that you will always remember later on, and was a person who was a big help in your development, in your education. And this is what you see in this classroom, where kids from all over the world, there are migrant children and refugee children who are in this class with Miss Keat. And that's a new world for them, because they have to learn the Dutch language in this class, and when they get in, they're pretty confused and don't know what to do, and they don't understand each other, and they don't understand the teacher. So
yeah,
that is what you see in the film, how they develop in a year's time.
Petra, how did the film come about?
We simply wanted to make an ode to a teacher, because we think in every country, wherever you are, you need good teachers in order to develop yourself. And we asked a network of teachers in the Netherlands, please come with proposals for an extraordinary teacher. And we got a letter about Miss Keat from her colleagues. And they wrote a love letter about her of 2 pages to us.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that letter said, a love letter from her colleagues about her?
They praised her courage to start a class with foreign small children, with refugees. And she praised that she is quite strict, but extremely demanding at the same time and extremely warm. So it's her, this mixture that makes her so interesting.
Yeah, her warmth.
For many people.
Her warmth combined with her sort of, sort of firmness.
Yes, that's the better word, I think.
You know, but what's interesting is that the camera is not often trained on Miss Keat. It's really more the kid's eye view. And I'm curious if this was initially to be a movie that's really about Miss Keat and that, was inspired by what a great teacher she is. Why do we see her so little?
Yeah, that's a good question, because when we got to her, she was she invited us in the class and we could immediately see the warm atmosphere in the classroom. And within 10 minutes, Petra and I, we winked at each other and we said, well, this is going to be it. We don't need to think about it. And she agreed immediately, but she had one big but. She said, this film should not be about me. It should be about the children. I don't want to be center stage. And in hindsight, this is what really was the decisive moment for us, because we had to think about it a little bit, but then we said, okay, we'll turn the camera around and look at the children, because in the end, via the children, who are kind of a mirror, we have a portrait of her, of Miss Keat as a teacher. The quality of the teacher, you see it in the way the children develop. So even if you don't see her that much, it is a portrait of Miss Keat at the same time.
Something that amazed me watching the movie is how you guys must have really just been total flies on the wall in this classroom, because there are scenes where the children are talking to each other in such an unguarded way, like as though nobody's there watching them or listening in, you know, like you are just in this kid's world. And I should let our listeners know, we're not playing those scenes for you just because they're not in English, they're subtitled, and that would be a little hard to follow for most of our listeners. But tell me how you got that kind of intimate access.
We were there from the first day. So the children thought it belongs to this classroom, that there is a filming team. At least we guess so. And the situation was that demanding to them that they didn't have time to think about us at all. And we could be very nearby the children all the time, and they wouldn't care about us. They simply were too busy with learning the language and learning to know Miss Keat and learning to know the new culture and so on.
You know, you've mentioned this before, but the kids and teacher don't all speak a shared language. Did that present a challenge to you guys in understanding what was going on? Peter, why don't you take this one?
Yes, it was a challenge, because especially in the beginning, the kids who speak Arabic would, you know, with low voices would speak with one another and share their feelings, and we could only wonder what they were saying. So we would rush home with the footage we had shot and ask the translator to give us the information, and it was a kind of a gold mine for us, these little conversations between the children. And it gave a very special level to the film. So we discovered in a very early stage that this is going to be really, really important for the film.
One of the
and we,
oh, go on.
we had to laugh a lot because we got a lot of surprises through the translation. For example, you have a scene in which George, a young Syrian boy, is singing about Mesquite and how he hates to be in this classroom and how he hates it to learn and so on. And so he expresses his
feelings.
His feelings, yeah, in a singing way. And you, when you don't understand the language, you don't understand the message at all.
So you just see this kid singing, "Oh, how cute!"
Yeah.
And then you go home, and it's like, "I hate school."
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And for Mesquite, it was sometimes a surprise as well. She laughed about it, too.
Yeah, because she also wouldn't know.
No.
No, because she doesn't speak any Arabic. And the kids have to learn very fast to only use Dutch in the classroom, which is also a constant topic amongst the children. Because when one child is kind of left out because the others are speaking Arabic, you would shout, "Stop speaking Arabic, you have to speak Dutch." So they learn pretty quick, within a few months, that they use the few Dutch words they have to communicate. So these funny Arab dialogues, they kind of diminished after a few months.
But one of the first things, I mean, the first scene where you have a bunch of children together, I mean, you originally just see Mesquite getting her classroom set up for the day of school, and then a little girl named Maya arrives with mud on her pants. She's wet and she's crying because she's uncomfortable. And Mesquite gives her a hug and offers her a change of clothes. She's very sweet and warm. But then Maya walks off and starts telling the other kids that she wants the teacher to call her mom.
Yes.
She's trying to get the other kids to ask for her because Mesquite doesn't seem, she thinks Mesquite doesn't understand her as well as she understands the other kids. But then you've got one kid saying, like, "No, I don't want to ask for you." And another kid saying, "No, I don't know how to ask that question in Dutch." And they're just kind of milling about, kind of negotiating with each other, almost like it's a business deal.
Yeah, it is. I think the thing was they were playing and they didn't want to be disturbed while playing. So this girl comes with a kind of awkward question. So how are we going to handle that? So better say we don't know. At last, the last boy is offering to help, and he translates the question to Mesquite, if she can call her mom and tell her about the wet pants. And Mesquite says, "No, we're not going to call home. It's no big problem, and your pants will dry very quickly, and I give you a new warm pants." So that this kind of also, you know, for the girl, it's a big problem, and Keith handles it in a way to make this problem a little bit smaller so it won't last all day.
Tell us about Maya's character.
She can be very aggressive, and she, because she is afraid, she lived in camps quite a long time, and she
In
refugee camps, and she learns there that she has to be the boss in order to survive. And this behavior isn't accepted in the class of Mesquite. And she learns to become a nice girl. And this development you can follow in the film. And the wonderful thing is that you see her fighting with all the other children all the time. And at the end of the film, she is friend with a lot of the children in the class. And now she is one of the best friends of all the children in the school. She's very loved.
There's also George. I mean, I'm not pronouncing it quite the same way that the students do, but you mentioned him. He was singing in that scene you talked about. He is an interesting character, and this is true of all the kids, but I find it especially true of George. So much of the drama plays out on their faces, and George's mm-hmm. expressions and just general demeanor are totally unique.
Yes, he is unique. He's a wonderful kid. He's very bright. He has been through a lot of terrible things, and we only know a fraction of the things that he has and his family have experienced through the war. And we know that his father almost drowned in the Mediterranean and that his friends rescued him. And so these are, of course, things that have made a very big impression on him and his little kid brother, Maxime, who he brings along into the classroom. And they stick together very tightly. And so with Georges, you see that in the beginning, he resists everything. He doesn't want to be in school, and he doesn't want to learn, and he doesn't want to have this teacher. I think he just wants to be left alone and wants to sleep, because he has enormous sleeping problems. He has terrible nightmares, and so has his brother.
Because explosions, I mean, has this past of explosions disturbing his sleep.
Yes, yes. And what you see in the film is that little by little, he calms down, and he starts to see that Mesquite is a trustworthy person, and that he can rely on her, and that she's actually very much okay, and he likes to start learning, and so this is kind of sparks off his development.
Well, Peter and Petra Letaster, stay with me through the break. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from Yancey Ford, whose documentary about his brother's death is part mystery, part poem, and part personal history. It's also part of the True False Film Festival in Columbia this weekend. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And the first Friday of every month, we do a show focusing in on some of the arty things going on in our area. And this month, we're dedicating the show to the True False Film Festival in Columbia, because it's such a big deal for Columbia and because there are so many incredible documentaries going on there to talk about. Next up is a movie called Strong Island. It's the filmmaker's quest to understand his brother's death, but also to kind of take back the narrative about his brother's life. Yancey Ford, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. When you made this film, it had been more than 20 years since your brother's death. What inspired you to take it on at that moment?
I had been making my way toward a movie about my brother, his death, and its impact on my family for quite some time. And when I began pre-production in 2006, it was simply because, you know, I had been speaking with a friend who did not know at the time that we met that I had a brother, even, and that he had been killed. And I shared with her that I had been considering making a documentary about what happened. And she asked me simply, "What are you waiting for?" And I didn't have an answer to that question. I realized that I had been, sort of stuck in this pattern of silence and shame that comes along with a death that goes unpunished. And when she asked me that very simple question, I realized that I had to, at that point, start the process of making the film. And we, 10 years later, have Strong Island to share with the audiences here at True False.
Let's let our listeners hear how the movie opens. During this scene, we just see you at a desk on the phone.
Hello, it's Yancey.
Hello, it's Dimitri Jones returning your phone call.
Hi, Ms. Jones, how are you?
Okay.
I am not sure if you remember my name or my brother's name. He was a homicide victim back in 1992.
when you were with the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office.
Okay.
His name was William Ford. You worked on the case with Stephen O'Brien and Detective James Hughes.
Okay, what do you want to know?
I was calling to see if you were willing to, within, you know, your legal restrictions, answer some of the questions that have been sort of plaguing me for the last 22 years.
No, I'm not going to do that.
Okay. Do you mind if I ask you why?
Because as a prosecutor, everything that happens in the grand jury is confidential, so I'm not
sure.
going to
right.
discuss it.
No, I'm asking about the investigation.
Yeah, no, I'm not willing to discuss any of my prior cases on film with anybody.
May I interview you by phone?
No.
Okay, and you don't
want... Why do I want to discuss the case with you?
And you don't want to make any comment on your behalf?
I do not want to make any comments.
Okay, Ms. Jones. Thank you.
Bye.
Oh my God, so cold. I mean, I start the movie feeling infuriated on your behalf, even though I actually, at this point, have pretty much no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, that call didn't go very well,
no.
as you can hear. And it was very difficult. You know, all of the calls that I make to the people who are involved in investigating my brother's death and presenting the case to a grand jury, they're all cold calls. And you know, what's not in the film is my process of figuring out how to get in touch with people, you know, and making phone calls and not having anyone return them, and then, you know, sort of sitting around all day with my cameraman waiting to see if anybody would ever call me back. And you know,
I wondered about that because, yeah, you're getting a return call and the film is rolling.
Yeah, well, like 5 seconds before I answered the phone, my DP and I had been sitting at my dining room table eating lunch. And that was just the nature of, you know, the process of making these phone calls. You know, we called people. I had left messages, you know, at Ms. Jones' office, both in Manhattan and in Suffolk County, multiple times. And one day, when I was planning on making other phone calls, she happened to call me back that day. So there's a lot of waiting. There was a lot of waiting involved, in getting in touch with these people. And the moments when each person called me back, or when Ms. Jones, for example, finally took my call, are so unexpected that the stumbling that you hear me going through and the surprise that you hear me going through, you know, that's happening in real time. I got more used to waiting, and I got more accustomed to, handling my own anticipation and nervousness about talking to these people. But I never knew what anyone was going to say, and I certainly didn't expect that response.
One of the things that you say to the prosecutor is that you hope she can maybe answer some of the questions that have been burning in your mind for all these years. What kinds of questions do you have? I mean, first of all, I guess we should... Could you briefly let people know sort of the basic
sure.
circumstances of your brother's death, and then the questions that you had.
Sure. So the basic circumstances of my brother's death are sort of in three parts. He and my sister and his girlfriend were on the way home from bowling one night, and they were sideswiped by a tow truck. My brother sort of brokered an arrangement between his girlfriend and the shop that they would fix the car for free if she didn't file an insurance claim. The repairs went on for some time. My brother went to the shop to ask angrily why the repairs had not been made in a timely fashion, and then threatened to, have the place shut down because there were pretty substantial rumors that it was a chop shop. Not the night that he threatened to have the place shut down, but on another visit, subsequent visit, he was arguing with the shop owner and the young man who was driving the car, who hit his girlfriend's car, came out of the back of the garage. And my brother saw him and, followed him into the garage after saying to his friend, that's the kid who cursed out my mother. My brother turned the corner and a shot rang out. And he had been shot with a .22 caliber rifle, which pierced his heart. And he died later on that evening at the hospital. So my brother wasn't armed. He had never, threatened this person and didn't know that the person was on the premises that evening. But that young man claimed that he shot and killed my brother in self-defense. And so the questions that I had for Ms. Jones were really about the investigation and the narrative of the perpetrator's fear, seeming and, over time to have, replaced the language of investigation. There was no talk.
So this is the questions about was the perpetrator's fear of your brother, this idea that this would have been self-defense, is that legitimate? Because I don't know if we've established that the shop owner is white, if I'm correct, and your brother is black.
That's correct. My brother happens to be black, and the shop owner and the driver of the tow truck who shot and killed my brother happened to be white. And in 1992, on Long Island, it's one of the most segregated places in the country, there was an all-white grand jury who, essentially was able to hear a story of someone who had apparently been terrified for his life for a period of some 3.5 weeks, but who, didn't have any of that fear, at least as far as I'm able to tell after, making this film, didn't have any of his fear dissected or interrogated as much as my brother's life had been dissected and interrogated. The police know down to, the minute, whether or not my brother was at the gym on a particular day. But, it doesn't seem to me that, anyone asked, well, if you were so scared, why didn't you call the police instead of going outside? And so the film really asks us, and it really looks at what we fear and how, our ideas about victims and perpetrators are far too often influenced by race.
You do some interviews with your mom and, among other people, but your interviews with your mom, they're not all focused on your brother or even on this incident. A lot of them kind of take us back into her childhood, into the history of the neighborhood you grew up, the history of why you were in that neighborhood. I'm curious why you wanted to take us back so far into your family's history and so deep into that family history's relationship with maybe larger history, like history with a capital H.
Sure. I think it was important to go back, into my family's history because the unraveling of my family and to understand how my brother's death, affected us all. It's important to understand what the family was before he died. And also, to understand that the invitation into the movie is not the murder itself. The invitation into the film, that I try to make to the audience is to come in and get to know my family and get to know the story of who we are. And then once you know who we are, you can see, sort of almost chronologically when the murder happens, how it undoes, different people in our family. And I think that too often we, we see people, black men, who are killed, and we think that their stories or the stories of their lives and the stories of their families begin and end with their death, when in fact, you know, that my brother's death was just a point on a line in my family's story. And, you know, racialized violence in my family, especially, and I think it's common in black families who, you know, where the, my parents grew up in the Jim Crow South, you know, racialized violence in my family goes back to 1942, to an incident that we hear about in the film, where my father's, or my grandfather, rather, while he was having an asthma attack, was made to wait in the colored waiting room of the local hospital. And while he was waiting, you know, he died. So, you know, the longitudinal understanding of the way that, you know, the family existed and, you know, was whole, as well as the way that racialized violence has interrupted the timeline of my family, is as important as the, you know, the death of my brother in the overall understanding of how race and racism really do sort of cast a pall over the entire criminal justice system, as my family experienced it.
In addition to interviews, this film has these scenes that are, I don't know, like photographs kind of being rearranged on a desk, it looks like, but the shot mm-hmm. is from above. And so you see, yeah, you just see different family photos being arranged into different configurations. And then there are also some scenes of you talking directly to the camera in mm-hmm. what seems, it has a feel of being very unrehearsed. There mm-hmm. are expressions of pain there on your face that seem very spontaneous. There are stumbles that you don't edit out. But there's mm-hmm. also, it's so concise and mm-hmm. the language that you use that it's hard. Tell me about those scenes.
Sure. Well, those scenes, I felt that it was very important as a director to put myself in the same position that I had put everyone else in the film. No one who I interviewed in the film knew what I was going to ask them in advance. They, you know, I didn't give them time to, you know, rehearse or, you know, or anything. I simply said, can I interview on this day? Will you come and talk to me? And everyone said yes. And everyone tried to answer the questions that I asked them as honestly and fully as they could. And I also said to every person I spoke to, this is not about being perfect. It's not about, you know, having perfect memory or not being yourself. We are simply having a conversation. My character, you know, when I'm in front of the camera, one of the things that we had to do, because I'm, you know, I'm in front of the camera, which means I have to hand over the reins to the person who's interviewing me and my producer. My interviews were shot over the course of 4 years. And they look, you know, very consistent because my cinematographer, Alan Jacobson, is really brilliant. But I had to construct a wall of sound blankets between me and the rest of the crew so that I couldn't see anyone. And the camera lenses, you know, are the only things that I can see in a room that is otherwise completely black. And I needed to create a void where I could almost feel as if I were alone. And being in that space allowed me to summon the courage, for example, that you see in my mother in the film, to answer questions honestly, to say things that I had never said before, and to not have the pressure of perfection. And, you know, I think that you, there's also another moment where I, you know, I sort of fess up to, you know, to some, you know, cheeky behavior when I was a teenager. But all of those moments are real. And I think it's to the credit of the people who interviewed me, like Rob Moss or my producer, Jocelyn Barnes, that they pushed. They pushed me to answer questions. They also didn't know what I was going to say in response. So the energy that you feel there is real, and the revelations are real. And but it's what I owed the people who had participated in the film, was to be as honest as they were.
Yancey Ford talking with me about the documentary Strong Island. Hang tight through this break. When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll be talking to all the filmmakers we've just spoken with about the blurry line between truth and fiction in documentaries. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. Hi again, Yancey.
Hey there, Gina.
That is Yancey Ford, director of the documentary Strong Island, which we've been hearing about. It's a personal interrogation of his brother's life and death, kind of a memoir. And hello to you, Petra and Peter Letester.
Hello.
Hi, Gina.
Petra have co-directed a documentary called Miss Keats' Children. And that documentary takes place in a classroom in the Netherlands where a lot of the students are refugees from the Middle East who do not speak Dutch. So they have kind of a negotiation to go through with their teacher, who is this warm but firm character in their lives. And we see them transforming throughout the film. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking to these directors from the True False Documentary Film Festival in Columbia, Missouri this weekend. You know, the whole idea of this festival is to explore the sometimes uneasy pairing of art and documentation, fact and fiction. I wonder if, starting with you, Yancey, could you talk to me about that distinction? I mean, is filmmaking, when it's documentary filmmaking, all about the facts, or can there be, should there be poetic license?
Well, I think that it's important to, you know, remember that when you're talking about filmmaking, you're essentially talking about a visual medium. And there is information to be conveyed both through images and through words. And I think, as you can see with Strong Island, I think that if you, as a director, you know, make the right choices for your story, that there isn't really an issue between, poetic license and truth, because they ultimately are one in the same. For example, at a certain point in Strong Island, you see, a shot of the house where I grew up. And it's just a shot of the house where I grew up with the clouds rushing by, overhead. But what's being said by my character underneath that image, those two things combined, are, I think, more powerful than either one would be separately.
Want to jump in because we have a clip that's from a moment like the one you're describing. I don't think it's the exact same one, but mm-hmm. we're seeing this suburban split-level house where you grew up in Long Island, and we're hearing the story that sort of unfolds after your brother's death, where the investigation is ongoing. In it, you're telling us about the summer after your brother died, and we're just looking at your house while we're hearing this.
Countless number of times, at all hours of the night, during the summer after my brother was killed, I could look outside the window and there was a car parked across the street. That car and whoever was in that car was watching our house and trying to intimidate my parents. The phone rang in the middle of the night, every night, for months. When I was home, I unplugged all of the phones in the house, except for the one in my room, so that my parents could sleep through the night, so that they wouldn't have to pick up the phone and say hello and not have anyone respond.
Yancey, I mean, that is a tough scene. Talk to me. you know, a lot of the things happening here, obviously, we have not traveled back in time to your family's home as these things are actually happening. And maybe it seems like a silly question to ask, but what do you think about, you know, there's a car that's set up on a street and you see rain coming down as we're talking about that there's a car parked outside your parents' house. We're hearing this phone ring that clearly is not the same phone ringing at that time. Can you talk to me about all of that piece of truth and fiction in documentary filmmaking, the setup kind of?
Sure. Well, part of the challenge that we faced with Strong Island was making a film in part about something that happened so far in the past. I had very little archival material, and we needed to figure out a way to help convey and help represent memory. You know, part of what we did was try to stick very closely to the things that we knew. So if we knew that there was a car parked out in front of the house, we simply parked a car in front of the house and shot that from the perspective of inside the house. If we knew there was a phone ringing, we found the phone and we let it ring. It's, you know, these choices creatively are meant to, you know, to bring the audience inside a period of time that's in the past, clearly, but to convey the way that the feeling of the character who's telling the story, you know, what that person went through. And in this instance, it's my character talking about this phone ringing and the car being parked. And so we layer visual recreations of memory, you know, along with, you know, audible recreations, along with my character telling the story. And what it does, I think, successfully, is bring you as close to living through this experience as possible.
Okay. And I don't mean to cut you off. I want to jump in because I do want to also hear from Petra and Peter about the same kind of thing. What kind of truth are you guys hoping to capture? It sounds like Yancey is capturing the truth of memory and the truth of feeling and the truth of personal lived experience, you know, that is often still going on in the characters' minds because they live with these memories all the time. You have a similar challenge in that we're getting the stories of these children by just observing them while they're interacting in another language, while, I mean, so many layers between you and the journeys these children have been on, in many cases from the other side of the globe to the Netherlands.
Yes. I think when we talk about truth, or I would like to really call it truthfulness, because I was almost jumping to also to react to Jancy's story, because I think this is what was told was a beautiful scene to me, and that's about it's a reconstruction, and it's all about truthfulness. You're not really showing the truth because it's not there, but you are, as a filmmaker, presenting your truth to the audience, and you try to do that in the strongest way possible. And what we try to do in our film, our way of filming, which is very observational, is that you, I think, try to focus on the human interaction which is going on in front of the camera, and trying to do that in as clear and vivid way as possible, to be how would I say, to make it, to leave out the things that are not important, that are only bothering your vision, to make it simple in a way.
So the truth is about selecting what to include and what matters.
Yes, you need a sharp focus. Truth is not showing everything, which I think can be very diluting the truth or making the truth very vague or misty.
Yeah.
You have to leave out what is in its way, I guess.
Well, Peter and Petra Letester, makers of Miss Keith's Children, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
And Yancey Ford, thank you for telling us about Strong Island.
Thank you, Gina. Thanks for having me.
You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/Central Standard. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. And our music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.